Hi, everyone. Welcome to Nancy's Metaphysical World and More. My name's Nancy. I host the show, and today I have another great guest. His name is Andrew Inzorn, and in quotes they have AJ. So, Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, Andrew, can I call you AJ, or do you prefer
Sure,
Andrew?
Sure.
AJ, okay. Let's do this right off the bat so a lot of the listeners know who you are. Can you kind of give a little idea of, you know, who you are, basically, what you've done, and what brought you to start writing books?
What brought me to start writing books was Harry Potter.
Okay, that's a good one.
My first book was Luke Carter and the Sword of Kings, and I wrote that after I read the Goblet of Fire and realized that the author's largest audience, which was in North America, was just going to be excluded from her most international book. So that's what started me writing books, period. And then after I had finished that, my agent, he was having problems finding someone to write a book that he needed to distribute. And he knew that I had started in journalism and that my journalistic beat was actually medicine and science. And he asked me to write the Bird Flu Survival Handbook, and which was a nonfiction.
Okay.
And then shortly thereafter, probably within a few weeks of that having been published, Peter Jennings did his journalistic broadcast on a UFO incident that happened over Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And this brought back a stupendous amount of memories for me. And while I had never considered myself a nonfiction writer, I had, back in the early 80s, attended boot camp with a man that would go on to essentially become intimately involved within the intelligence community and extraterrestrial contacts. And so I had been sitting on the story for 20 years at that point, but what Jennings did was more personal than anyone could imagine, at least from my point of view, because the incident took place in DuPont, Shiloh, and Lebanon, Illinois, mm-hmm. primarily. And I had lived both in Shiloh and Lebanon, and I had worked in DuPont. So even though I hadn't been in Illinois at that point for quite a while, that incident really kicked me into going and thinking that, well, one, finally Jennings, a man I knew personally when I worked in New York City as a freelancer, and somebody I admired deeply, had turned something journalistic that was originally the butt of everybody's jokes,
mm-hmm.
and it had no credibility whatsoever.
Okay.
And so I decided, well, I can't tell everything I know without, you know, I took an oath also as a Marine. I can't tell everything I know. So my decision was that I would tell what I could so long as I would do no harm.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the human quantum leap came in.
Okay, now, a lot of people, I'm sure, that are listening, you know, at least I should say my listeners, a lot of them believe in many things, without a doubt, or they wouldn't be listening to my show, because I talk about UFOs, I talk about all kinds of paranormal things, and I talk about kind of life in general with what happened to a lot of people. But with you living in those towns, let's kind of go back a little bit. Did you ever see any UFOs around there while you were living in any of those towns?
I personally have never seen a UFO.
Would you like to?
I have no ambition. I've never had no ambition to see a UFO, and I am just a journalist. And journalists operate entirely on the credibility of the material that they develop.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. And Josh, my friend from the Marines, he was an extremely unusual person in that he was very much what one might call like a clinical sociopath. He wasn't the type of sociopath that went around killing people indiscriminately, but he killed on orders from his government, certainly, and he did that quite a few times, and it never bothered him. He was the type of person that if there was a bomb that needed to be defused, were anyone else going up to that bomb, their heart would start racing. Josh's heart would slow down.
That's different.
Yes, okay. And on top of all that, Josh was a bona fide genius. Okay, he wasn't somebody who talked the talk. He was always somebody who was willing to go out and walk the walk, okay? And it didn't matter if it was academics, okay? And it didn't matter if he had to go to war. He was ready to go take care of whatever it had to be done, and he was always ready to do that. So he was, in and of himself, a very unusual person, and I understood entirely, having got to know him originally, why the Marines would pick somebody like him to join the intelligence service. He was
In your book, you talk about the intelligence service, and you talk about how some of the things that are in your book, the Introduction to Human Quantum Leap, can actually kind of baffle some people, or kind of maybe, let's just say, freak some people out.
At least freak them out.
Okay. And as you talk
about... At the very least, you can get freaked out.
At the very least, okay. And as you talk about Josh, you know, you talk about, like, you know, just by listening to you now, and I don't know this Josh, but it sounds like that not only was he very, very intelligent, but is there a possibility that there was a lot more to him than, you know, what most people would ever think about knowing? Like, I mean, inside your book, you talk about Esther, you know, the ETs, let's call them, that are here now.
Right, right. But you have to understand that Josh would never use the word ET. He would never use the word alien. If you raised the topic with him, you were wasting your time, okay? Even if he was stone-cold drunk, okay, which unfortunately is how he and I often communicated via alcohol, it was a waste of time. He was in total denial about what they might be, even though he always knew what they were, okay? Mm-hmm. But where we connected, okay, what we had a common interest in was the science. And so while I can't go around telling people that, you know, even though I've met one of them completely by accident, that we are being visited, that there are people here in the now, okay, what I can say is I can't talk about their science because that's what Josh and I always talk about.
Mm-hmm.
That's how we got past the taboo of the topic, by sticking to scientific discovery and scientific reality, their science versus ours, how ours is a disreality, how their science is the greater reality. And there was never anything personal involved, okay? It was just pure fascination.
Mm-hmm. But with Josh being in some special department, let's call it, it sounds like he was kind of privy to a lot of information that, you know, a lot of people weren't, especially our normal everyday people who are walking around.
Yeah, but that's why he was picked. He wouldn't... His greatest art was keeping his mouth shut.
I think he
had it down to an art form.
I think what he was going to, you know, with what he was doing, he'd have to be able to do that. Otherwise, he probably wouldn't be around very long to talk about anything, I would assume.
Yeah, and as we talk right here, anyone listening in, if they want to get on the same page with us and they have the internet in front of them, they can go right now to www.gohumanleap.com, and they can bring up on their computer exactly what it is we're talking about.
Okay, so it's www.gohumanleap.
Human Leap.
Oh, Human Leap.
L-E-A-P.
Okay, .com.
.com. So they can just pull that right up, or worst comes to worst is Google A.J. Enser. How it got up to 102,000 hits, I'll never know. But I only just found that out when my nephew called me yesterday and said, "Have you Googled yourself lately?" I said, I don't Google myself at all. Why would I? I know who I am. And I tried it, and, you know, 102,000, that was kind of wild.
It's kind of fun, I would think. The thing is, there's a lot of people, AJ, out there who truly, truly, without a shadow of a doubt, believe that we are visited every day by many, not just one or two, but many different, let's say, outside our realm.
Well, the truth lies in whether or not you yourself have any paranoia about it, okay? But if we go into the science, okay, what I can tell you is how they get here, how they travel. You know, I can tell you how I found out about these things, okay? I can't tell you who they are, okay? But I can tell you all the things that originally fascinated me and I put into the book.
Okay. So can you tell us a little bit about, then, what is in your book? For example, you said how they get here. Most people are assuming that they just fly in on a little spaceship or whatever the case may be.
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that.
I would think so, but can you explain it a little bit?
Sure, I can explain it a lot if you want.
Oh, that's great.
It's one of my greatest fascination, okay? They don't travel the way it is depicted in our science fiction, okay? In fact, the man that Josh eventually wound up being the bodyguard for, who I called John in the book, and that's what Josh called him, John, he's a scientist, okay? He's just an observer. He would be, in our world, an anthropologist, okay? And he's come here to observe. And the reason he came here to observe is the same reason that the United States was chosen as the nation that was first contacted by them, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for the first contact is the test that they're looking for. And the test is twofold. You have to be, you have to reach a point in your evolution that, one, you knowingly and deliberately use subatomic structure as a tool.
Okay, and for some people, what would be considered some atomic structure? What would it be?
Oh, a nuclear generator.
Okay.
Unfortunately, an atom bomb.
Okay.
But also, there are, you know, certain chemical phenomena in the formation of, say, plastics and stuff like that, okay? You have to have an in-depth knowledge of subatomic structure in order to make plastics.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's the test number one, okay? And number two, you have to be the inventor of a computer.
Okay.
And that's the thing that the United States had that no other nation had. One, we had used subatomic structure, and two, we invented an artificial computer, an AI, a machine that could think for us
mm-hmm.
and solve problems for us, okay? And the reason that this is so critical to these individuals is that each one of their civilizations has gone through the same evolutionary event. And when those two things come together, okay, it marks the beginning of a very large jump of a civilization that has anywhere from 100 to 350 years of a window of opportunity where they essentially join the rest of the galactic family. And so that's the reason they're here, okay? There isn't any other reason. And what happens when people apply their own thinking and their own reasoning is that they don't think like us, right? They aren't motivated by the things that motivate us. They have no interest in conquest or control. They have no interest in being our leaders or helping us develop. All they want to do is observe because that's what they did, and they want to see it happen someplace else. So now we come to the science of the travel. How do they get here? I have had a very big lesson myself personally over the last 30 days since the book went active on the internet. I have to confess that I haven't known very much about the UFO paranormal community, not only in the United States or around the world, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But there is a lot of culture that backs it up. It goes from the very impressive to the very strange, but there are a few commonalities in it. And one of those things people have heard technology-wise, as I have learned in depth now, is the word of called a graviton generator, okay? And this is essentially a device that generates an artificial gravity field. And the primary way they travel, the primary way they communicate is through the use of gravity. And essentially what happens is it works like this. You have a place that you want to travel to, and your technology has developed to such a level that you're able to observe that particular target over a great distance. And what you are able to do from a distance is you're able to track and measure the magnetosphere of a particular target and its sun, its resident star. And that information that's being pulsed out into space all the time, 24 hours a day, contains a great deal of information about that planet and its evolution and what goes on there, particularly if it's full of life or not.
Mm-hmm.
But also, wherever you are, the planet that you are in orbit in or live on, it also has a gravity well. And all gravity wells in this universe are connected. All black holes are connected. They are all part of the bubble that we call the expansion of the universe. And what you are able to do with your technology is that you can, standing on your gravity well, you can now look for the same signal coming from the planet that you're targeting, and it matches the signal that's coming out across space. And using those two signals, along with the resident star, you are now able to plot a course into and through the gravity wells that connect these two places together.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially what happens is you plot your course and you engage your graviton generators. And what happens is a gravity field comes up around your ship, and you are pushed into what I call first dimensional space. And why do what most scientists on Earth call it the fourth dimensional space? But I call it the first because it was here first, and all that we perceive in this universe is dimensions 2, 3, and 4, and they are all emergent properties of first dimensional space. You are also artificially pushing yourself into the fifth state of matter, the first four being solid, liquid, gas, and plasma. When you generate this field around your ship, you are creating the fifth, which is gravity-impacted matter.
Okay.
And now you are free to move into the gravity well where you are at and to come out of the gravity well you have targeted. And that, in a nutshell, is how they travel.
That's kind of cool. I'm sure a lot of people are going, no, it doesn't make any sense to me. But I would think that that would be very possible.
They have to keep in mind that once you are gravity impacted matter, okay, you are now part of the subatomic structure of the universe. And at the subatomic level, any scientist will tell you that there is nothing solid.
Mm-hmm.
And That is essentially how it works. And John knows about our science fiction. It's part of, you know, he studies our culture, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't laugh at it, but, you know, it's from his perspective, you have to imagine that something like the Starship Enterprise, okay, would cross some extraordinary matter that has been unimpacted by energy and could ignite a star from dark matter just by traveling through it, okay? Not that they would survive the encounter to begin with, okay?
Right.
But there is no, from John's point of view, there is no rationale for trying to cross three-dimensional space. It's just absurd.
When it comes to John, if you know the one that you're talking about, do you know where he's from?
Josh said John tried to explain it to him, okay? But there isn't any word in English that translates to, you know, John's natural speech, okay? And Josh was never particularly good with star charts or anything like that, okay? You know,
mm-hmm.
He knew a few key stars that he could do land navigation with when he had to. He was trained to do that, okay? But he could never really point out where John was from. And he felt extremely uncomfortable even suggesting that. I mean, if he picked up his finger and pointed at a particular star, he would have to move away from his denial that he's dealing with an extraterrestrial, and that was just something that was a distraction he didn't want to live with.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, he was in denial.
I mean, most people here are in denial, if you ask me.
Right. Well, we all got our problems.
Well, see, a lot of people have this idea that we are the only living, breathing, brain-toting thing in the whole entire universe.
Well, that's interesting, because John did explain to Josh one time that although when we look out into space, we're looking backward in time, time is the same everywhere in the universe, and as far as existence itself goes, okay, whether we're on this particular side of the expansion of the universe or the completely opposite, existence has the same length, and John says that spacefaring races only gave rise 350,000 years ago, and now that's depending on who you talk to, somewhere between 200,000 and 250,000 more years than the species of Homo sapiens sapien that we are gave rise to in Africa, okay? But 350,000 years in the age of the universe is nothing. It's absolutely nothing. And he said, John knows who the other races are, but the only way they can meet is what they call on common ground. Earth would be considered common ground. Both would have to adapt to life here like John has adapted to life here. And in that state of adaptation, they would have to meet, okay? But because the universal means of communication is gravity, and they all have that means of communication, they know who each other are. They have in-depth knowledge, and that's what we as a race are moving towards, that level of communications. I mean, the 150 to 300-year window I spoke of earlier, that's just to the point where we join the communication, the common communications that the rest of the universe has, and we come to a new understanding of who we are and our place in that universe. But, you know, to become a space-faring race may be as far as 1,000 years in our future, but how necessary that is, given all the information will be provided once we get to where we're going, it may become a moot point. We may not need to travel.
Well, it would be kind of interesting not to have to. I think it'd be fun to travel some, you know, at least sometimes. Does John ever say anything to you, or has ever said anything to you, about the 2012 phenomenon that's going on now? You know, everybody's so scared of 2012 coming in.
I completely by accident met John, and if I could have avoided the event, I would have. And my only communication with John was, hello, how do you do? Nice to meet you. He was on his way out, praise the Lord. And after he walked through out the door, all I could do was go and lay down on the couch, where I stayed for a good hour, because I just about went into shock. I had no idea how much John knew, how much I knew about him, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I feared for my life. Look at these people that keep these secrets. They are intent on those secrets being kept, and they're prepared to use deadly force to keep those secrets. So while I am fascinated by all the science that surrounds John and Josh is gone now, that's the extent of my involvement, my particular fascination with all the scientific possibilities. Heck, until 30 days ago, I didn't even know that your community has conventions. I was going, they have conventions?
All over the place.
Holy Lord.
All over the place.
And one interviewer says, are you going to go to one? I said, no. Not unless you got a lot of money. Because look at this type of material comes with a great deal of baggage. And while I'm very happy to share what I know, I share what I know this way, talking to you at a distance, and I share what I know in a book that anybody can, you know, get for $12 simply by logging on to Amazon or going to the address, you know, humanleap.com, and that's really the extent of it. This makes me very nervous. This past year, I got rid of all my credit cards. My driver's license doesn't have my address on it. I don't own a phone with my name on it, and I live on an island off the coast of Florida, in a gated community. So I've deliberately isolated myself in anticipation of releasing this book this year.
When you first met Josh,
That's funny.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
In the Marines?
Uh-huh.
Oh, well. It was an interesting time. We were both 18 years old, and we were both met on Parris Island, which is in South Carolina. And life got very strange. Neither one of us knew what to expect when we wound up on that island. We were both patriotic individuals, but we also, both of us, just happened to have scored extremely high on the entrance exam to the military.
Mm-hmm.
I had been a very good student at a very good parochial school, and Josh really was a genius. He was just brilliant beyond, you know, he belonged at MIT. If he didn't have all the problems that he had, he probably would have gone to MIT. And so we met there, and I, for reasons that have completely been lost to time in my memory, I turned to my bunkmate one day and said, you know, how did you do on that test? And I started getting a list of numbers from people in the squad, of which there were 60 of us, and for the most part, most people scored somewhere between 55 and 70, and I was starting to feel like an outsider because I had gone through most of the platoon and nobody had scored, you know, 93.5 like I had.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got to Josh, and he scored a 97. So I told him, and all of a sudden we had this common ground. You have to understand that boot camp makes an individual extremely insecure.
Mm-hmm.
And finding any common ground when you're under so much pressure 24 hours a day, is a great deal of relief. And so, you know, Josh didn't talk much to anybody. He only talked when somebody talked to him. Otherwise, he was, even at 18, he was really good at keeping his mouth shut. And basically, we simply went through basic training as kindred spirits. And we had a lot of adversity in boot camp. We just had the unfortunate luck of having a senior drill instructor who himself was a borderline personality and a sicko, basically. I mean, he would enthrall us with his stories and escapades in Southeast Asia and the Philippines, and he was basically an evil person. And so and we were, both of us, Josh and I, were on the receiving end many times of his sick outlook on the world. And so, you know, that also brought us together. And that's basically how we became friends. Now, we both went off to training, and I, unfortunately, was involved in an accident and gave me a back condition that sent me home. And Josh went on to 29 Palms, California, which is a fairly unpleasant place. And he completed his training and moved on.
Do you think Josh wanted to be part of the Black Operations Platoon, or was he just kind of put there?
He had no idea. Nobody has, 18-year-olds joining the Marine Corps haven't got a clue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They have some expectations, all right? But nobody really knows. Nobody really knows. And so he could not have understood the depth to which he would be tested. But, you know, thank God that he had the personal tools he needed to make things happen and to survive. I mean, even at that time in 1980, the Marine Corps had like a 1.8 mortality rate during peacetime because the training was so dangerous. And so there was always, particularly when you're training the way Josh was training, and you know, you don't make it and you wind up in the infantry, what we call the grunts.
Mm-hmm.
You make it and you move on to do things that are probably even more dangerous than the training.
Doesn't sound like a fun time, if you ask me.
Well, you have to keep in mind that everyone, even today, who is in Iraq, who is in Afghanistan, they're all volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they chose to be there. They knew what was coming, and some of them re-up. Others wind up in mental hospitals, but whatever it is that has pulled them in, whatever aspect of their personality lives for that, that causes them to drive on. That was part of Josh. I have to tell you that, you know, that the Marines are a highly motivated group of combat fighters, you know, warriors, and I never really was. I was just, you know, good at the things that I did. And the people that were always trying to motivate me or overly motivated, they just wore me out. And And the manifested itself usually in the way when you got into a bar and they were all drunk within a couple hours, and I hardly drank at all. And these days I don't drink, period. So, you know, you wind yourself up like that to prepare to go out and fight and die for your country, and you don't know how to relieve the pressure. This is the explanation for why Josh and I always were able to come together, and he was able to blow off the steam that he needed to blow off. He was just under an enormous amount of pressure.
I would think so. With what you know, AJ, do you think that our government has lots of little special operations like this going on that they really, truly do not want the public to know anything about?
Well, it isn't just the public, the American public, it's anybody, period. And mostly what concerns the U.S. government, its security operations, is our enemies out there. And, you know, what steps will they take to bring down another World Trade Center? And what rationale, a rationale that most of us here in America cannot even relate to sufficiently to come to an understanding of why such events would unfold. They keep those secrets to keep us safe, not because they don't trust us, but they do assume that having been elected to office and having set up an administration that, to a certain extent, they're entitled to a certain amount of trust and their judgment, and keeping things secret certainly falls within that.
Well, their big thing is to constantly deny that there's anything as a UFO in any place that's been around.
When it comes to UFOs and extraterrestrials, it's entirely plausible that the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing, okay? The person making the denials may truly, in fact, know nothing about what the right hand is doing, okay? And the reason that is connected to the word black on black. And black on black means you have a need to know. And if you don't have a need to know, you don't know and you're not entitled to know. For example, an operation that Josh was involved in, if the President of the United States had a need to know, it would be at a point where a decision had to be made that nobody within the organization could make on their own. And so that's the point at which, say, the President of the United States would then be informed about a black-on-black operation, okay? But I can't sit here and tell you that the President of the United States knows anything about any of this stuff because I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
He may not have a need to know. I mean, these individuals who come to visit, they may have rules that have to be followed in order to, if we want, you know, the agencies that are involved want to stay in contact, and they want those rules enforced. So they may be setting the rules by which contact takes place, and everybody else may be going along with it.
Do you think that we have used some of, let's just say, the ETs, expertise in different fields, like lasers and things like that?
Yeah. Those devices all have a very complete and detailed history going back decades and decades, and any historian could track it down for you.
Because a lot of people question the Roswell. After the spaceship thing over in Roswell, that's when all of a sudden a lot of different kinds of technology seem to surface.
Well, I go out of my way in the book to very plainly state that I don't know anything about Roswell. And I give away, you know, I have an email that I'm happy to give out to people who have questions, and I'll give that to you now. It's AJENSR, that's without the O, at AOL.com. I say to people, if you want to send me an email, fine, but I don't know anything about Roswell. But to get back to your point, you have to keep in mind that one of the things that they came here to observe is our use of the computer. And we expected, this has been talked about in media for years and years, that once we have the computer out there making our calculations, helping us to analyze material, that our technology would develop exponentially. And right now, computer technology is doubling once every 36 months. The ability of those computers to analyze and to aid and assist us in our own scientific development is also doubling once every 36 months. So what you've seen since World War II is an exponential, a widening of our ability to do accurate, effective research over a much shorter period of time. And it's just a cause and effect. And for people to arbitrarily attribute that to alien visitors has no merit and does a great disservice to all the people who work so hard for so long to make that stuff become a reality.
Okay. The other thing now, is the black ops same as Men in Black?
Men in Black, yeah. What about it?
Are they the same group?
Oh, no. No. Men in Black is, MIB is a fiction. I mean, there's this, the contact is very limited, very narrow. It's an exchange of consideration that has nothing to do with technology whatsoever. Government and government agents allow these individuals to sit back and observe what we're doing, and in exchange for that, all they do is have access to these individuals. What types of communications that go on, what motivates them, I'm not privy to that information. Like I said, it was always the science that piqued my interest, and that's pretty much the narrow range that I kept it, because the rest of the information was of no use to me. You know, extraterrestrials, how many are there, where are they coming from, it just wasn't in the conversation.
Did Josh's group have any contact with, say, other groups, say, in Europe, you know, like Russia, Germany, places like that? Did they?
I know for a fact that there has to be some measure of contact in Australia, because that's where Josh discovered who and what John was completely by accident. And before that, he didn't know. But Josh, as a bodyguard, was not part of a group. He was just an individual assigned to bodyguard somebody originally. His Black Operations Group as an organization was dissolved in the second Reagan administration. And they just found that their operations were redundant, and that they were better handled by other agencies within the government. And so Joss's entire platoon as an entity was dissolved. It's not like they would ever admit it ever existed anyway, but the thing is that he didn't operate as a group much after 1984.
Mm-hmm. You make a statement, all the things that you sent me are on the website when people go look at it. But you said one last note, and it said, "I do firmly trust that if a real extraterrestrial showed up in anyone's office, on their doorstep, or at their university, and explained who they were in perfect earthling language," okay, then you put down that nobody would probably believe them.
Right. Most rational people would just have you locked up. And if you showed up on the White House lawn, you would be locked up.
That would be true.
Okay. If you survived, if the Marines there didn't kill you, you would be locked up. Okay. So, you have to understand that in order to be here, John wears a spacesuit, and his spacesuit is a human body. okay?
Mm-hmm.
And what people listening to this have absolutely got to understand is this. This is a technology-based phenomenon. There's no body snatching going on here.
Okay.
And they use bioengineering the same way we use engineering to build a building. And that's what John's adaptation is to being here, all right? Essentially, he is more than one person because he's alive in his real form, probably on his own world. It's just that their technology has advanced to such a level that they can take consciousness itself, back it up like we would back up a hard drive on a computer, and reestablish it in another body the same way we would reestablish it in another computer. But as weird as that sounds, the very moment someone thinks that this is something other than a technology-based event, then you're way off track. It's only an adaptation to living on this planet. And that's what other races have to do. That's what I meant before by common ground.
Mm-hmm.
You get to meet another alien race only on common ground when you've
right.
adapted to that common ground.
Okay, let's give out the name of your book again and where they can get it from.
The Human Quantum Leap, and you can just log on to www.gohumanleap.com, and you can send me an email at ajensr@aol.com.
Okay. If people send you out an email, first of all, let's ask it this way. Is there a question too strange that you won't answer?
I won't compromise any security that might do harm.
Okay.
That's why I won't give out names, you know. Josh was actually Josh's first name, really was Josh, but his last name wasn't Smith.
Mm-hmm. A lot of Smiths running out there, though, we know.
That's why I named it. Okay. I mean,
you said that you actually had this for 20 years before you wrote it. Did you hold it because you were waiting for Josh to actually be gone, or did you just hold it because you thought people would look at you like you were some kind of a nut?
Right. Nut.
Both, huh? Okay.
Nut. Nutcase.
In that case,
right? Yeah, you have to understand that you know I have done the book tours, particularly with Luke Carter and the Sword of Kings. I did a huge book tour in 2005, and for reasons that go beyond rationale, I would be sitting autographing books, and as soon as the crowd would dissipate, someone somewhere, and you know this. This happened in Southern California, it happened in Toronto, it happened in New York, it happened everywhere I go. Somebody would come up to me and somehow connect the possibility that they could talk to me about extraterrestrial events and Roswell and all these other phenomenons because I was an author of a fiction and I personally could never connect the two. And here I was sitting there, a well of information. But I was always afraid that having made the connection between these, I would be like this person who was coming up to me out of nowhere
mm-hmm.
and saying and acting crazy things. And I pitched the book to a publisher at the Toronto Expo in early 2006. And I explained it to her, I started, you know, hearing things coming out of my mouth that just didn't seem rational.
Mm-hmm.
And that bothered me terribly. It bothered me terribly. And so I said, this isn't working. I'm just not comfortable with this at all. You know, I trained as a journalist. I need to live by those standards or otherwise I don't have any credibility. So thank God for Peter Jennings.
I think Peter took a big step when he did that because he was so well known and because people trusted him so much, it gave it a great deal of credibility. And to have him, you know, do something like that, I'm sure turned a lot of heads in a different direction.
Right, right.
you know, include.
It opened up a door because now you see, at least on the cable side, a great deal of UFO material. Some of it drives me right up the wall, but you see a lot of it now, and it wouldn't have been there otherwise.
Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, people getting out of their box, let's say, like Peter Jennings, like yourself, are really very important for the people who are here just kind of waiting to hear some truth. Because, you know, a lot of the media is very one-sided or very, let's just say, not as truthful as it should be. And everybody who's sitting there listening to it just falls for everything that they have to say. And I have a hard time with the way that that is done to, you know, the media. You know, with what they say, what they censor, what they think everybody wants to hear, things like that. So truth needs to be, you know, out and about. And if it takes somebody like Peter Jennings to come through and say, yeah, this blah, 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 and then somebody else like you needs to come through and write a book about it, it would probably help people to, you know, look in a lot of different directions rather than just be very much kind of contained, like what the American people have been as far as media goes.
I'm not entirely certain what it is that everyone wants from the truth, really. I've never been able to answer the question, you know, what is the personal gain? Because you now know that there are races from other worlds. It's not a far-fetched, even as a guess, to believe that we would be alone in the universe. But to actually know that we're not alone in the universe, I've always had a very strong inability to understand what it is that drives people towards this truth and what they expect to get out of it. I'm always thinking that the reality isn't going to live up to their expectations, not the least of which because the way I've come to understand the paranormal community now is that it's based on a great deal of finger pointing and a great deal of mythology, and it's become near impossible to divide the two up.
Mm-hmm.
So, I wonder what is it that people want from it, and I try to explain it to them rationally, but even coming out of my mouth, it doesn't always sound very rational to me.
Does that make you kind of feel bad or feel strange because it doesn't sound, you know, rational coming from you?
Right. It makes me very uncomfortable, okay? That's why I say you got to have a lot of money. You wanted me to show up for one of your conventions because there's nothing else going to get me to one of them.
Are you afraid of what you know?
Not really, because it opens up a great deal of hope for the future. We are already seeing the early stages of the human quantum leap, in that we now see in our news reports, particularly in the sciences, where individuals are being hooked up to computers, and they are able to control those computers to a certain extent simply using their minds, giving paraplegics a new lease on life. And while what is happening there is not yet a direct interface between the human mind and the computer, we are at the baseline of learning how it is done, okay?
Mm-hmm.
When that connection becomes direct and we can not only network ourselves with our computers, but we can network each other together, we can start solving problems on a level. We will, you know, it'll continue the process of development changing once every 36 months to the next level, to the next level, to the next level. And we will figure out how it is that everyone communicates using just gravity, and then we'll be able to do it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that people will have a hard time with that thought, even though it's being shown to them?
I think people have a hard time with the entire concept and the process, period, okay? You're not the first, even before I published, you're not the first person I've told some of Josh's stories to. And Josh's stories can get really creepy. And not because of anything Josh ever had to do with those stories, he just got into situations and stuff started happening around him, and all he could do was react to it, okay? And but I've told these stories to people, and when they very slowly come to realize that I'm telling them the truth, that there really are other races that they're as far above us on the evolutionary scale as we are above chimpanzees in our forest. They don't think of us in that context, okay? But that's where they are, and that's where we have to go to. And I've seen people completely turn white coming to the realization that human is not the end-all that they thought it was.
Yeah, and it really isn't.
Right.
I have to agree with you.
We're not the center of the universe, and having to deal with that on a personal level can make people panic.
Yeah. I talk to a lot of people, believe me, I know how true that was.
Right, yeah.
Now, our time is almost up, and it's been a pleasure talking with you, but before we go, could you again give out the name of your book, where they can get it, and your email address?
Oh, the Human Quantum Leap. They can get it at www.gohumanleap.com. I think it's $12. You know, you can use a bank card or a credit card or whatever the process is. And if you wanted to send me an email, you can send it to ajensr@aol.com.
Now, you basically told us a little earlier that you've kind of cut yourself off from everybody. Are you ever going to start showing up again and be out and about with all the public?
Well, we'll take that one step at a time, okay? So all those conventioneers out there, if you got 10 grand plus expenses, you know, send me an email, and I'll negotiate, okay? But I live on an island. The rest of the country is in the 40s. Today it was in the 80s, and, you know, I like the isolation, particularly at this particular time when I know that there are individuals that could get out of hand very quickly on this information.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to really have to deal with people going off on me. I'm just trying to share. And I don't want my sharing event to turn into something that it shouldn't be.
I don't blame you. What would you, just real quickly, I got to ask you this because I've been dying to ask you, what would you do if an ET or somebody like John happened to approach you and said, hey, you know, I need some help. Can you help me?
I'm willing to help anybody who needs help, so long as it's rational.
Okay.
But if it's irrational, I'm not the person who can help you. So, you know, I would, you know, give you ideas of what you might want to do, like getting back on your meds. But I'm not that person. I mean, if someone come up, I know a few things about extraterrestrial travel that I'll never share with anybody. But if that person could answer my question, you know, I might take him seriously.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that I want to keep this all on an even keel. I don't want it getting away from me. I don't want anybody to be hurt by it. That's what I meant before when I said I don't want to do any harm.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, some of the feedback that I've been getting about the book has been extremely positive. People aren't just reacting to the information I provide, but, you know, the opening part of the book is rather colorful, the way Josh and I met in boot camp and some of the things we went through, and people are finding it very funny. And you know, I laugh at it now, too, but it wasn't funny then.
Mm-hmm.
When I sat down to write this thing, I said, well, you know, what can I get away with that, you know, that isn't going to hurt anybody? So basically, I simply explained how we met. I went into, you know, about five stories that Josh had shared with me. Then I explained how Josh discovered who John was. And then there's the last chapter, which is aptly named The Book According to John, which simply explains how the universe formed, why Einstein wasn't accurate about everything he thought he was accurate about, what is the flaw in our science that's keeping us from realizing the larger truth. It's very detailed. And in fact, it was so detailed that some of the PhDs who read it had to read it 5, 7, 9 times before they got it. And they said to me, this is too complicated. And so I actually had to dumb down the last chapter. And it took me 10 days to write and 3 months to edit. All right? And it was all because there was too much detail. It was going over everybody's head, okay? So I kept making it simpler and simpler, making the concepts. It's not the way I would sit and explain it to an audience of scientists.
Okay. You know what? Andrew, our time is up. It's
okay.
Been great. The name of the book, again, is Human Quantum Leap. And you can give out your email one more time. How about that?
AJENSR@AOL.com.
Andrew, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.